Welcome back to another episode of The Dirty Inning, another rollicking, rip-roaring ride through the archives of Phillies history, stopping only at the points that are the least interesting and most yellowed by history. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight, and with me is Trevor Strunk, notably from Baseball Prospectus. Hello, Trevor.
Hi, Justin. How are you?
Pretty good. It feels like it's been a while.
It has been a little bit of a hiatus for this podcast.
Bit,
not as much as our one hiatus, which was like 8 months.
Right.
But is that a new title that you have, head guy?
Nope. Same title. Came back. Same title. But yeah, I will say this podcast is certainly one that is, I feel like, the most susceptible to long disappearances from its hosts.
Like, well, just, yeah, because it's not like Hidden Season or it's a little like Continued Success in this way, but you still had a deadline there because it was the anniversary. Like, it is a little bit trickier because it's like, it's not as if, you know, if we don't talk about a dirty inning, it's going to become like less, I don't know, less relevant.
Well, I don't think people realize that we actually live states away from each other, and mm-hmm. we record using one single long wire with a pair of
That's
old
correct.
Tin cans. Right. So that is a problem. You know, birds landing on the line.
You wouldn't believe the kind of maintenance that's necessary to keep this kind of thing up.
Yeah, it actually takes a ton of work. People you'd think that would be the most streamlined way to do it, but no, it actually is deeply complicated and full of many, many obstacles, both natural and man-made.
There's a lot of talk about a podcaster's highway, that's what they're calling it, where they will put underground wire, telephone, you know, string, not anything fancy, to tin cans all over the eastern seaboard. But, you know, we're just going to have to wait to see what happens on that. I'm not holding my breath.
And I think we can all hear the listeners of this podcast screaming, yes, by God, yes, get that system in place, because this podcast, more so than any other, needs to be broadcast into our ear holes as quickly and frequently as possible.
That's right.
So, yeah, I feel like that's an important, that should be a priority for whoever's in charge of that. So, who runs the podcast sector? That I feel like they actually would have a person for.
Yeah, that seems right. I mean, you could find someone that would do it. You could just ask any podcaster and say, your salary is $25,000, and they'll scream in joy and take it.
You get, 2 cents per download, plus you have to advertise this particular organic grass t-shirt company in every commercial break.
Organic grass t-shirt company. Justin, I've been looking for an organic grass t-shirt and I just can't find any anywhere. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, Trev, like most Americans, you find yourself with a bag full of clippings following every lawn mowing session. What do you do with those? Well, they'll tell you can compost them, use them for many other horticultural needs. But frankly, our science has proven that this is a waste of time. And especially when you could be saving money from your t-shirt rentals by ironing
t-shirt rentals are through the roof.
Ironing your lawn clippings into a garment for you to wear to social and professional events.
If only there was a company that could help me do this.
Yeah, well, there's not.
Oh.
So
but if
oh. But this is where that or any company could advertise if they so chose. Before we get too far away from the very abstract and loose topic that we discuss on this podcast, we should mention that, yes, this is, again, a Phillies podcast in which we talk about the dumbest innings in Phillies history, some of the most monotonous, some of the most painful, some of the most boring or long or inane or silly, you know, and anything of that nature. We discuss them here on this podcast. And today, Trev, oh boy, we found another one for which you and I were alive for. And that,
oh,
I know, is
great.
That's always a special treat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always like being alive for these. I was trying to tell someone the other day about the podcast and why it's good. And the only thing I could tell them...
It's hard, isn't it? It's really tough.
No, I mean, it's not that hard. But I did tell them that it... I told them that we talk about collusion in the Hall of Fame.
Cronyism.
Oh yeah. Well, it is collusion
or it's both.
Via cronyism. Right. Yeah. But yeah, that is my main sell for the podcast, I have to admit.
Yeah, it is good that we seem to know what we're talking about in relation to words and terms related and unrelated to baseball. Yes, I totally agree with that.
Well, yeah, it's a funny podcast and people should be listening to it. Is this where I should be advertising our podcast you're already listening to?
No, there's really no reason for that.
Okay, well, let's get to the game then.
Complete waste of time and energy. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah, no, May 14th, 2005, almost 15 years to the day. Well, wow. almost 14 years to the day. Almost 15 years because 14 is close to 15. You see
ready,
where I was at.
Ready to feel old, 2005 was 15 years ago.
Wow. See? And I do. I feel old. I also feel old because I hurt a lot. Mm-hmm. I have just a lot
that's
of pain.
Important.
That feels like, you know, I think my bones are dying. Off topic. Anyway, the Phillies, speaking of dying, the Phillies played the Cincinnati Reds on May 14th, 2005 in a real humdinger of a game that saw Aaron Harang of the Reds and eventually Phillies taking on Randy Wolf of the Phillies and not eventually the Reds as far as I know.
Maybe Randy Wolf had a lot of weird minor league stops. He joined the Brewers.
I was going to say, I believe he went to the Brewers. But yeah, this was a game that Aaron Harang was never really noted as anything more than effective starter.
He was very good against the Phillies, though. Am I wrong about that?
No, I mean, you know, not entirely wrong. He's certainly, we remember him having good games against the Phillies because I think they faced him enough that eventually he just spun out some solid games here and there. I don't think, especially after he joined the Phillies, at one point he was actually very good with the Phillies. Leading up to the All-Star game that year, he was with the Phillies. I remember writing something about how Aaron Harang was their All-Star. And then, you know, he copiously shat the bed with reckless abandon.
That rocked.
Yeah.
That was cool that he did that.
It was a cool year. What a fun summer.
what year was that?
I don't know, 2014, pick one. They all sucked.
None of those years were good. They were really bad years, huh?
It's a bad baseball team, Trev, and that's why we do this podcast, The Dirty Inning. The Phillies had a small lead for most of this game that was utterly decimated when the Reds scored 10 runs in the game's final two innings.
Oh boy, I wonder which innings we're going to be talking about.
The Phillies and Reds were both, at this point, dangling under 500, not looking particularly favorable among their division rivals.
Okay.
The Phillies actually handed the Reds just absolute ass-whooping on Friday night, beating them 12-2. Thanks to Bobby Abreu and Todd Pratt going off against the Cincinnati bullpen.
Worst name.
Yeah. It was a loss for the Reds that put their manager, Dave Miley, in a real shitty mood. Asked about the issues facing his 13-21 club, his top two starting pitchers were sucking, his staff was giving up double-digit hits every night, Miley just responded to reporters by smiling and nodding to multiple questions. They just kept asking him stuff, and he would just smile and nod back at them. Trev, have you ever been so mad that you couldn't speak?
Yes, but never in front of a press conference.
This is what's interesting to me. I think a better question is, can you imagine a more upsetting repeated response from someone you were trying to get a quote from?
Yeah, it's a little terrifying.
You know, at least if he screams at you, cusses you out, causes a scene.
Like, ooh, that's a quote.
You can write about that easily. Yeah. That's the story.
This is just, he seemed as if any second he was going to murder us.
Yeah, right?
Like, it's not great.
Is he waiting for, like, something to get in place? Am I, like, going to look down and see a giant X below me? Or is it just, like, we're going to be looking at him and slowly but surely you're going to see, like, ants, an increasing number of ants crawling out of his ear?
I like imagining he just keeps nodding and then one question, he just opens his mouth and starts screaming at a higher and higher and higher volume.
Yeah, it's the sound of, like,
everyone
a bird.
Leave.
Well, asked about, no one wanted to ask him any more questions after he took to responding in that manner. But Miley had
weird.
Miley had good reason to be driven totally deranged at this point. Sean Casey, who I believe was his first baseman, he was typically a 300 hitter. He was unable to stop hitting into double plays at this point, leading all of baseball with 12 of them in mid-May.
Yikes.
Which, that is a lot for just a month
mid-May?
And a half into the season.
Yeah.
So that included 2-1 game the previous night.
Oh, no.
They keep making great plays on me, Casey lamented to the press. I'm not exactly Dave Roberts running down to first either. Poor Sean. Yeah, he was crediting the Phillies defense for getting him out, which, you know, hey, when you're having a frustrating streak at the plate, the last thing you want to do is give the 2005 Phillies any credit for getting you out. But he was perfectly willing. Pitcher Brandon Clausen was learning how to walk on his sprained left ankle all over again with some soft jogging. And Willie Mo Pena was recovering from a strained quad by running in a pool. And all 21-year-old Joey Votto could do was watch helplessly and anonymously from Cincinnati's High A affiliate in the minors.
I was going to say, that's not going to help too much. Having Joey Votto is great. Having him in single A is not so much.
Having barely not a teen Joey Votto is, yeah, not as big of an asset.
He probably could draw a few walks from the 2005 Philly staff.
Well, the Reds did have a couple of hitters worth seeing. Joe Ronda at third was having a solid start to the year. Felipe Lopez was hitting almost 300. And before Saturday's game against the Phillies, Ken Griffey Jr.
I was going to ask about him.
Yeah, you know, this was going to come up. And yeah, it's going to come up again. Ken Griffey Jr. took batting practice from his father before this game. His father had been planning to, I think he was going to.
What's that guy's name?
He was going to take a I need names, man. He was going to take a trip, but his son made him hang out and throw batting practice for him. Because,
that sucks. It's a grown man at that point. You should be able to take trips.
I can't go, guys. I got to throw Ken Griffey Jr. batting practice. Stop calling him that. We know he's your son.
I have to throw this guy, Ken Griffey Jr. batting. Your name is Ken Griffey. We know who your son is.
I don't know. He's kind of good, I guess. Whatever.
He's no Ken Griffey Sr., whoever that may be.
Well, despite Griffey hitting safely in 15 of his last 17 games, Jr. wanted his father to check out his swing, saying, quote, "Father knows best."
Ugh.
In this case, that was probably literally true. The 35-year-old Griffey's extra work may have even contributed to the role he'd play in the day's game, which sucks. Trev, what does your father or any parental figure that you have know best?
Ooh, boy. I would say my mom knows how to cook for a crowd best.
Hmm.
She's always able to put together like a nice meal. It always surprises me what she makes, and she likes thinking about it. So it's I think my mom knows how to cook for a crowd best. My dad's good at cooking for a crowd, but he always makes like pasta or meat. It's always good, but I think mom has like a kind of creativity to her. That's what she does best. How about you, Justin?
Okay. I would say that my father is a very skilled grill master.
Nice.
And passionate. He also
Have you gotten any of his skills? Have you inherited anything?
I don't know. I don't think I have. I've definitely passionate about grilling. I can't say that I'm particularly good at it. I succeed in turning the food from raw to blackened, which
You do. That's one thing you want to do.
I'm also not equipped to really handle to do premier grilling. I'm working with a tailgate grill that
you gotta get a grill.
Well, yeah, I know I gotta get a grill. I just haven't yet. I'm telling you what the current situation is, that I'm working with a tailgate grill.
Look, sorry,
a plant stand.
I'm sorry.
And I gotta poke at it with a pair of tongs. Like,
listen, Justin, don't get angry. Come on, pull it together. Let's.
I'm just saying everything's fine. Just stop asking me about it.
Don't become Mickey Mouse. I'm saying everything's fine.
I told you I wasn't going to lose my composure on the podcast anymore, but you do this to me. I know you do it on purpose. I would also say my mother has a very sickly old cat, and she's very good at taking care of and defending it from intruders. So,
who are the intruders?
Guests, young children who want to pet the cat, but maybe are too young to understand that it doesn't want to be pet.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. That kind of cat always does need some protection.
Yes, she's got very fast reflexes for defending this cat. I gotta say, it's a sort of reflexes that probably would have helped the Phillies during this game. Which am I saying my mom could have played a better shortstop than the Phillies shortstop in this game? You know, yeah, potentially.
I think my mom could have played a pretty good. I bet my dad could have played shortstop in 2005 for the Phillies better than this guy did. He was how old was he?
We are talking about Jimmy Rollins, just for the record.
Whoops. 2005. I forgot. So, I thought maybe it was Kevin Stocker.
Yeah, this is like 26-year-old Jimmy Rollins. Like this is Jimmy effing Rollins.
Am I saying that my dad at 51 was better than Jimmy Rollins in his prime? Yes.
I mean, I'm saying my mom, because she has a cat, would be a better shortstop than Jimmy Rollins in his prime. He's a three-time All-Star.
It feels like maybe we didn't appreciate Jimmy Rollins enough.
You know what's crazy? 2005 was the last year Jimmy Rollins was an All-Star.
Really?
Is that...
Even when he won MVP?
Even when he won MVP.
How didn't he make the All-Star team that year?
That is a terrific question. One I feel like we should probably just figure out right now, because how did that happen?
That's
what are we talking about? Okay,
that's
so
2007.
So this is like Jose Reyes. You know, that was his comp. It was JJ Hardy. Was he any good for the Brewers at this point?
I mean,
like,
he was good. I don't think he was.
Reyes started at shortstop for the National League, and on the bench they had JJ Hardy was the backup.
Oh my god!
Wow, I nailed that.
Wow, that's impressive. I would never have guessed JJ Hardy.
Man, they had four first basemen counting Prince Fielder, who started. So they only had room for two shortstops, and it was Reyes and Hardy, and Jimmy just didn't get the votes, I guess. Wow,
that's unbelievable.
Yeah. He didn't lose any time to injury that year. He played in all 162 games, and you know, wow. I can bang out his MVP stats for you here. Led the league in at-bats, led the league in runs scored, led the league in triples. He hit .296.
I mean, I know that's a contentious MVP, I know. Like, some people think that he didn't deserve it that year, but I don't think it's contentious that he deserved the All-Star nod.
I mean, okay, we can say that has been contested, but being in consideration for MVP at the end of the year, here's who was behind him. Matt Holliday on the All-Star team. Prince Fielder started on the All-Star team. David Wright started for the All-Star team.
Yeah, like this is weird. What a weird thing. Yeah. I never thought I would hear that Jimmy Rollins was not on the All-Star team that year. I have completely forgotten that. That should be talked about all the time when we talk about like injustices in Philadelphia sports.
I honestly, the only thing he won after 2007 was three gold gloves.
Huh.
Like, as far as league recognition goes.
Boy, yeah. People really forgot about him. I mean, he'll probably make the Hall, I would think.
So, yeah, it's a little surprising that Jimmy didn't really get a lot of accolades after that. I had not planned to talk about this, so that's kind of interesting, because Jimmy doesn't factor too much into this game on May 14th, 2005 that we're talking about today.
Okay.
Ken Griffey does. Griffey would hit .301 in 2005 and play in 100... playing 128 games.
I didn't know he ever had that good a year for the Reds.
That's exactly the point I was going to make, is that once he gets to the Reds, in my mind, you know, this is when everyone's starting to think of, like, this is back half Griffey. This is, like, not as, you know, clearly the career is going down. He's suffering from injuries and everything. And, I remember thinking, like, oh, Griffey's in a Reds uniform means Griffey's done, when you're, like, looking at his career. Yeah. So, I was surprised to see that he actually, he hit over 300 for the Reds in 128 games in 2005. And 128 seems like a lot of games in one season for, again, this version of Ken Griffey. He even got a few MVP votes in 2005. Part of that is obviously name recognition.
Well, yes, of course. I mean,
but that was for the same reason he was an All-Star the year before.
That's fine.
This was all better performance-wise than my memory indicated at this point in his career.
Yeah.
Things were pretty much downhill from here for Griffey, though. Though he would get a sort of obligatory All-Star appearance again the next year at 37 years old. But still, good Griffey was apparently alive, and the Phillies were about to learn quite well.
Just how alive he was.
But never mind that for now. The Phillies had all the juice in them of a team that had just shattered their opponent in front of their own fans. They were ready to rock this weekend series against a team that was considered a punching bag league-wide.
So they're going to win real big, right?
Well, Trev, punching bags don't punch back. The Reds, it turns out, still had a little more life in them than a bag of, you know, rice hanging from the ceiling.
What's in a punching bag?
I was just going to say whatever's in a punching bag. We'll figure that out after this first break. Philadelphia, 2005. The Philadelphia Freedom Concert on July 4th, hosted by Wayne Brady and Bruce Valanche. Trev, were you there?
Of course I was. You think I'm going to miss Bruce Valanche?
And Wayne Brady.
That was Wayne Brady's, like, that was when he was, like, big, man. That was just before he sort of got into the Wayne Brady Show and all that stuff. And, like, he was on Whose Line and he had the Dave Chappelle things. That was a big time for Wayne Brady.
Clearly, they don't ask just anyone to host the Philadelphia Freedom Concert. If you're going to get anybody, you're going to get a Wayne Brady. You're going to get a Bruce Valanche. But that wasn't the only thing going on in Philadelphia at the time. It was blowing up. Tax breaks caused a condominium and population explosion in Center City. 10,000 more Philadelphians existed in 2005 than there were in just 2000, 5 years before.
Great. And did this bring with it an economic boom?
Well, when you look at the city today and see that everything's fine, I think it's clear that, yeah, the economic boom was well in play. You know, they're building schools on top of schools in Philadelphia. Hot dang.
They're building restaurants on top of schools.
And then closing the schools and opening prisons. Well, former Philly Del Anus was eligible for the Hall of Fame for the first time. Del Anus. What did I say?
I thought you said Del Anus.
Did I say Del Anus?
I think you said Del Anus.
Del Anus. Nope, did not. Hope I did not say Del Anus. Certainly meant to say Del Anus.
I really hope you said
Del. Well, anyway, Del Anus was eligible for the Hall of Fame for the first time in 2005. And Cooperstown, you know, he wasn't quite Cooperstown material, but that didn't stop furious Phillies fans.
Really? Del Anus wasn't Cooperstown material?
Well, I mean, he wasn't viewed as like a total shoe-in, I think. Okay. He wasn't like a slam dunk. So that didn't stop furious Phillies fans from approaching his widow as she left church with stat sheets explaining why he was. I read this this was like a side mention in an anecdote in a story in the newspaper. If you're going to approach someone to explain the candidacy of a particular player for the Hall of Fame, why would you approach his wife? Why do you think she needs to be convinced that he was good?
That's like, crazy.
I would assume she's on board.
Yeah, she's pro Dell, I would assume. She's
pro anus, yeah, as we said back then.
she sure was.
Let's get it in there was the Dell Anus Hall of Fame candidacy mantra.
No, we don't usually work blue on this show. I think it's good. I think we need to do this more often.
Well, at this point, I mean, Trev, you and I are in the same age bracket. We've lived through a period of prominence for Philadelphia.
Yeah, relatively speaking, of course.
It's been voted top city in all these different outlets. And I mean, you know, working in media, that's something that gets picked up a lot and run in local media outlets. So that's something we might be more aware of than other people. But it's Philadelphia's popularity had blown up a few times in our adult lives. And the Pope came here. The Democratic National Convention came here.
I'm pretty sure 2005 was the first year that the Good Fight was on SB Nation.
Well, and I mean, that's probably had a lot to do with its popularity at this time, because this was the first wave of Philadelphia being considered like the next great American city. And this was a National Geographic Traveler was the outlet that said Philadelphia, you know, it's kinged Philadelphia as the next big place for America to go to with the headline, Philly, really?
Wow. Talk about your great headlines.
I mean, I'm just going to read you segments from this article because it's funny how it contrasts with the Philadelphia we know. And it's really funny in what the writer is thrilled by in Philadelphia, which we consider like baseline Philadelphia stuff. But and what thrilled people about Philadelphia now. He's like, you know, Zahav gets rated number one restaurant in the country. You know, we've eaten at Zahav. You've been to Zahav. Like, it's cool to see the places that, like, you hang out in or know yeah. about getting, like, this national recognition. And that's the kind of stuff we've experienced in our wave of Philadelphia prominence. In this case, people were getting blown away by, like, Reading Terminal Market and, like, Broad Street, you know, fundamental Philly stuff.
Philadelphia, so, it's not just trash anymore.
I've noticed there's sidewalks next to the streets. Now I don't have to get run over. I don't have to be a victim of vehicular homicide just because I'm changing planes in Philadelphia. So this writer says, after decades of relative obscurity, Philadelphia, a classic American city, is ready to step back into the national limelight. Do they mean step back into the national limelight from, like, starting America? Like, is that when was the last time Philly was popular?
I mean, before 2005? Wasn't there, like, was there a Democratic convention there? I mean, obviously there was one later, but, like,
I'm sure there was. You're right. But, like, is that enough?
Does that count?
Before 2005 to be like, Philadelphia's popular? A bunch of politicians had a meeting there.
Milwaukee is ready to step back into the national spotlight.
But there's more. Rocky brought worldwide exposure to the city of brotherly love, but as a synonym for gritty urban decay.
I don't remember that part of Rocky.
Wait, you know, the part where Rocky goes on, like, an urban sprawl tour with, like,
a bunch of, like, grad students.
Right. Who are, like, a street art tour, and they're crawling through, like, abandoned buildings and stuff.
Like, he's just being told that he can't win the fight, and he's like, quiet, I'm looking at a piece by Banksy.
It's a mural of me.
Hey, Mick, it says I got a posse.
And he gets bit on the ankle by a possum. Yeah. The writer goes on to say, for years I've been hearing great things about this city of 1.4 million on the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers.
That is its classic nickname, city of 1.4 million.
The city of 1.4 million on the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers. Yeah, that is a very correct, at the time, nickname.
No one said it was a great nickname, but...
The city of 1.4 million. Yeah, that's true. When you're describing Philadelphia and you say city of, there's a certain expectation in your mind of what words are going to come next.
We truly are the most accurate city of all time.
He goes on to say, newspaper articles speak of innovative development projects. Friends return from visits, amazed that the nightlife is actually lively. It's no longer D.C. on a bad hair day, one jokes.
What
is that?
What does that
what
mean?
Is that? Like, it's not, like, overly windy. Obviously, there's another city that has wind on lockdown it's one of its defining characteristics.
Is it because, like, it's not cool? Like, is that what it's meant by?
It's like sloppy D.C. Like, D.C.'s boring but stately and well-dressed, whereas Philadelphia is, like, pajama pants and grease stains.
But wouldn't
that
make Philadelphia cool? Like, I don't want to be a contrarian here, but, like, if the comparison's between, like, your nerd friend D.C. and cool guy who, like, is sort of a little bit sloppy but, like, can party, why would you want to be D.C. in that instance?
Well, trust me in that this writer doesn't strike me, and probably won't strike you, as someone who, like, knows what cool is. His characterizing of this is probably not going to be totally accurate. He seems like a total goober. He's talking about how great Center City is and the Cira Center, which is of course the building, for those who are outside of Philadelphia, the building right next to 30th Street Station that's, like, triangular and shimmery. And he talks about the Kimmel Center. He's blown away by the concept of First Fridays in, like, the museums and restaurants. And he's also blown away by Stephen Starr restaurants, which are
back in 2005, I think Stephen Starr restaurants were kind of great. Were kind of new, right?
Like, I'm sure.
I think he went to Budokan in 2005.
Oh yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. He mentions Budokan by name, actually, in the article.
I didn't go. It wasn't 2005, but it wasn't too far off from that. Yeah. No, those were cool then. Now they're not. Now it's like some of them are fine. You don't want to, like, it's not like you're gonna, like, you're not like you're gonna make a Facebook status about it, though.
Here he is walking through Reading Terminal Market. Move it, big guy! A vendor wheeling crates of oranges yells at me good-naturedly. I jump back. The bustle around here is exhilarating. Here's what I think about this. There is absolutely no way a guy pushing a crate of oranges through Reading Terminal is good natured when he says, "Move it, big guy."
Like, yeah, he also wasn't a nice big guy.
No, he also might not have said big guy. He might have said pig guy, or something else that is an insult of some kind.
I think it could have been a homophobic slur.
I've rarely been openly insulted in Reading Terminal Market. Usually you just get a lot of like looks from people trying to get stuff because it's a deeply constricted space. It drives me crazy to be walking in Reading Terminal Market behind slow people that you just can't get around. And that's like all the people who are in there at the wrong time. So I can see, if he had to be audibly corrected in Reading Terminal, then chances are he was standing in a main thoroughfare, just sort of gawking at the idea of like a store that sells sandwiches to people
in Philadelphia.
I'm not buying it.
A DC thing.
So he also talked to a few people in the city, and what says more about like classic Philadelphia resident that like it, when I say people from Philadelphia, what pops more into your mind than a philosophy grad student?
Oh, the classic, truly the heart and soul of Philadelphia. They're amazing philosophy grad students.
Yeah, listen to what this grad student tells this guy. Again, we're talking about a travel writer surveying Philadelphia, describing how popular it's going to be in the year 2005. He says, "I love the excitement in the air here and the smell. There's a palpable smell from people's collective moods."
Excuse me?
That is
disgusting.
You should be a philosophy grad student.
Wow. Honestly.
Piece of shit.
I don't wish that on anyone, but boy.
A palpable smell from people's moods? No, there wasn't. Moods do not smell. It certainly wasn't palpable. It certainly wasn't a smell.
That's a horrible thing to say. Like,
that's the kind of thing someone says when they're the kind of person who has to be told to move by someone pushing a crate of oranges. Like that.
A palpable smell. What do you do when you go out in the street? Do you remark upon it? Do you say like, "Ooh, the smell. You smell the smell today? People must be sad."
Go outside, take a deep breath through your nose, and then mention to the closest passerby, "Oh, you smell like you're in a good mood today."
See how quickly you get hit.
In Philadelphia. Yeah.
Of all places that you would try that.
The last thing I want to relay is how they talk.
We could talk about this for another hour. I love this article.
But the last thing I'll mention is they talk about how much tech Philadelphia is going to be upgrading, and talk about the internet and someone he was talking to city council member or somebody was showing him around, and they said their mission is to turn Philadelphia into one giant Wi-Fi hotspot. That's geek speak for putting wireless fidelity transmitters on light poles to beam an internet signal into citizens' desktop computers, laptops, cell phones, or PDAs. Subscribers will pay a small fee, waived in some cases, and will get screaming fast internet service that's almost as available as broadcast television signals.
Wow.
Visitors will be able to Google train schedules in Love Park, find a shoe sale while strolling Market Street, read a biography of Ben Franklin on their way to tour Independence Hall, or pay a parking ticket without ever standing in line. It's one of the most ambitious wireless plans on Earth. How soon will it be up and running, I ask? End of the decade? Oh, goodness, no, he says. By next year. Wow!
And that's, of course, the extremely huge citywide Wi-Fi we all know and love.
Which is, yeah, absolutely, definitely free in some areas. Yeah, and absolutely reliable. And I gotta tell you, finding a shoe sale while strolling down Market Street, I don't think that's an experience someone in Philadelphia has. Those two things similar. Market Street's not a street you stroll down. It's a street you kind of try to avoid if you can.
You go down it because you work there.
Right, exactly.
I think like it's funny to be thinking about like I just want to imagine that there was some like joker in the mayor's office who knew that the iPhone was going to sort of like start doing 2 and 3G in 2006 and was like, "Yeah, we can spin this." sure, it's citywide Wi-Fi. Yeah, that's right. That's what it is.
You told him what?
No, don't worry.
I told him the lights were gonna beam down internet signals into everybody's desktop computers. Is that not what you wanted?
Oh, why did we have LSD Larry do all the
just throws his PDA against the wall. It doesn't shatter because it's just a brick.
I love the PDA era because it just makes me think everyone was having constant public displays of affection. It was just making out in the streets.
What a time to be alive. Wow. Well, you know, if there was anything the Phillies were receiving on May 14th, 2005, it was not affection, Trev.
Oh, no.
So Bobby Abreu mashed a three-run shot off Aaron Harang in the third inning to give the Phillies a 3-0 lead, but Ken Griffey had an RBI double that got Cincinnati on the board. Weird side note, right before Abreu hit the home run, Ed Wade announced that the Phillies were trading Marlon Byrd to the Nationals for Endy Chavez. It's weird to announce deals in the middle of games, right?
I don't think that's... I mean, there's, like, leaks. Isn't that... That's kind of like what Hug Watch is. When people are like, oh, it's Hug Watch. Watch it. Like, oh, they're going to find out. They're all going to find out in the dugout and give each other hugs. But I think rarely does the news break. I mean, that was the thing with what's his name? On the Mets, not familiar.
Oh, but, yeah. Flores. Yeah.
Yeah. And he, like, cried because he found out. And it was, like, actually a thing. Because people were like, well, I guess he found out he's getting traded. That's awkward.
Yeah. So that's a bizarre. The way I read the story was that the deal was actually, like, announced during the game, which is, again, strange given that Bird was probably in the dugout, right?
I think the weirder thing there is that Wade announced it. Like, things can get leaked. Like, things get leaked all the time, and maybe in the middle of the game it's like the Phillies have acquired whatever, like Cliff Lee, and maybe Cliff Lee's pitching or whatever. I mean, that could happen.
Right.
Wouldn't be crazy. But you wouldn't expect, like, the GM to be like, yep, that's what happened.
Calling reporters out of the press box.
Come here, come here.
To his office. Hey, psst, yeah, get over here.
I
got
such big news.
Just break free of your Wi-Fi signal from the nearest light post and get over here.
I know you're all bound to these light posts, prisoner-like by our Wi-Fi.
You're paralyzed by the intense Wi-Fi hotspot provided by the city of Philadelphia, but get over here. Got some hot goss from the mouth of Ed Wade himself.
The last thing you ever want to hear about. Hot goss from Ed Wade. Hey, I hear it's mac and cheese in the cafeteria tonight. Some hot goss from E Dubs.
You didn't hear it from me. You're gonna want to wade on this one. All right, I'll see you guys in the caf. Well, Endy Chavez was supposed to give the Phillies another option in center field, along with Jason Michaels and Kenny Lofton, who Ed Wade called a good combination.
Sure.
They were not a good combination,
oh,
Trev.
No.
Wade was in the middle of some drama, by which I mean a report had come out saying that he was going to be fired if the Phillies were in last place within a month. The pressure was on to not have
the Phillies in last
place. To not do that, yeah. The pressure was on to make his wildest dreams come true. Because what I mean is, like, wouldn't you say this is, like, the funnest time to be a GM? Knowing your job is probably on the line, but you are being given this last chance. So, like, any plan you had in the back of your head that you were like, I could probably swing this trade. I could try to swing this trade. Like, yeah. To do the crazy shit that makes your team better. This would be the time to do it.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I mean, so, what's the problem at that point? You're just like, it's all, I don't know, it's all gravy to you.
Like, right, you're already a millionaire, probably.
Oh,
so.
No, I guess after I'm fired, my legacy will be tarnished.
Exactly. So, you know, it was a tricky time, but I in my mind, probably one of the more liberating times for him as a GM. And he landed on his feet. He wound up in Houston.
And he did a good job in Houston. Someone was mentioning this to me the other day. Like, we were talking about what he did in Houston. He actually did not do a bad job.
No, he didn't. I mean, you know, that's the thing with GMs. Everyone hates them in the moment. And afterwards, there's this period of reflection where everyone's like, actually, he was responsible for all this stuff. We have gone through it with Ruben Amaro in this city. And I think his legacy is just we've closed the book on it. But if you had told me that in, like, 2010, when he was at his most popular, then into, like, 2012 or 13 or whatever, when he was at his least popular, and then after he left the organization and went to the Mets, and everyone was like, well, you know what? He did make all those deals that got us all these young players on his way out the door. So, like, at this point, his legacy is intact, and, man, you never would have guessed it would be as positive as it is. But
well, yeah. And I mean, honestly, for me, like, Ruben Amaro is like, seeing him now, when like in the middle of, you know, the world of let's make sure we never have fun with any of our players because all we care about are prospects, and like pointing to the Marlins trying to go for the World Series one year and being like, you idiots lost Chris Paddack and Fernando Tatis, and then also laughing at them for being bad. Like, I like Ruben Amaro, who's basically like, I don't care about these people in the minors. Get me players who can hit. Get me players who can pitch. I will give you anything, whatever. Yeah. Just give me your good players. It's like, that actually rocks. Like, that's cool.
I'm trying to make my team better, not better maybe later. So that's why Ed Wade swung a deal with Nationals GM Jim Bowden. Yes, Ralph himself.
Oh, good old Ralph. I love him.
Yeah, well, anyway, it was Randy Wolf himself who singled in the Phillies' fourth and last run of the day, only to be tagged by the pathetically weak-hitting Jason LaRue of the Reds, their catcher, with a solo shot to make it 4-2 Phillies.
I remember Jason LaRue. Wasn't he? No, that wasn't him. That was someone else, because there was a Cardinals pitcher who was like, I think had to quit baseball or something because Johnny Cueto stomped on his head in a brawl.
Yeah, he was it was the backup catcher. I forget who that was too, but yeah, that definitely happened. Jason LaRue survived, but he did. He made it 4-2 Phillies with most of the game left to play, and we'll talk about what happened in the remainder of the game. Spoiler alert: it wasn't good. Right after we get back from this break. Well, Trev, not much happened between the fifth and the seventh inning on May 14th, 2005. The Phillies weren't really doing anything interesting enough. The Reds kind of, you know, they were not a very good team. They weren't just going to happen to score for no reason. Certainly nothing happened that would make Charlie Manuel think Ryan Madsen couldn't have locked this game up for him and allowed him to bring in Billy Wagner and call it a Saturday. That's how it was supposed to work.
I love calling things a Saturday. Well, to me, there's nothing better than calling things a Saturday.
Trevor, it's Wednesday.
It's a Saturday. Let's call it a Saturday.
I'm sorry, I've already called it. So,
happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday. Well,
bring out Billy Wagner.
This was you leave the room, Billy Wagner walks in, everyone's pissed.
Oh, man.
Billy Wagner again? God damn it. So that was how it was supposed to work back then. Phillies have a close game. Madsen comes in, this hot young hurler. He's the setup man for Billy Wagner, one of the best closers in the league. Wagner shuts it down. Game's over. But Madsen did not lock it up. And in fact, watched the Reds not only tie the game and then take the lead, but then break it wide open, all without leaving the mound.
Oh, no.
How much do you know about Ryan Madsen?
More than I should. I will say that much.
Well, I felt like as someone who, I guess at this point, the Phillies are probably the team that he'll have spent the most time with in his career.
Oh, yeah, I think without a doubt. I mean, his career isn't over, but I think it's over
it's
enough.
It's pretty much over. I was surprised. I was like, oh, yeah, he did. He pitched in 2018 for the Dodgers.
He was traded to the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Or no.
So he was.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was a valuable bullpen arm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got Jesus. He got the Nats gave up Jesus Luzardo for him and Doolittle.
Yeah, he was a valuable asset still last year in 2018. But I feel like having spent a lot of his career with the Phillies early in his career, we should probably know just by accident more things about Ryan Madsen than other fan bases. But there's I can't say that we found a treasure trove of information about him, but
no, I mean, he's not incredibly interesting, I would say, as a person, which is not a bad thing. I would say like when relievers are interesting as people, sometimes they're like Sean Doolittle, where you're like, oh, this guy's pretty cool. Like I like his social media. He seems to be a fun guy. And then more often than not, it's like, oh, he's a huge racist. he just loves racism.
Well, one thing I noticed learning that Ryan Madsen was a bright young man out of Long Beach, California, is how many of the guys from this 2008 team, the 2008 team, came from Southern California.
That was a
or
California very
California
heavy team. I think for a period of time in baseball, I just thought that California was like a place where all the prospects came from, and it turns out that's not true.
But man, I mean, Cole Hamels and Chase Utley
and Jimmy Rollins,
Ryan Madsen. Jimmy Rollins is from Oakland. Like, yeah, this is a lot of California boys on that team.
And like, and in like big positions too. It's not like, oh, it's a bunch of California boys and we just name a bunch of bench players or something. Like, I mean, Ryan Howard was from St. Louis. Obviously Chooch was from,
Panama.
Yeah. Panama. Thank you.
Shane Victorino's Hawaiian, obviously, but, right. Where's Jason Worth from? He doesn't seem like a relaxed Cal. No, he's from Springfield, Illinois.
Ugh.
Yeah. I was going to say he doesn't seem, he seems a little too tightly wound. To be
to be from Springfield.
But yeah, a lot of California boys on that team, and Ryan Madsen was one of them. Long Beach, California, Trev, a place where the local ball team is called the Dirtbags, which
I adore that. Why don't we have a hat of that already? Can we please get me and Justin a hat of that? Someone who listens to the podcast, order us things and give it to us.
Madsen had a plan to go to USC, but the Phillies made an uncharacteristically sweet offer of $325,000 that turned him pro. In truth, the whole reason Madsen had lasted until a later round of the MLB draft was because teams assumed they wouldn't be able to sign him.
Yeah, signability issue, sure.
Yeah, but this gave them hope that the Phillies hope that they would eventually ink their number one pick as well,
who was
first overall pick in the draft this year. A young man by the name of not J.D. Drew, but Pat Burrell, who was at this point driving from Florida, where he'd attended the University of Miami, back home to San Jose on what we can only assume is a one-week cross-country celebratory fuckathon, a victory lap around the fertile breeding ground of the American South's college campuses. And during this period, Pat Burrell was not available by phone. This was the time apparently he was using to determine whether or not he was going to sign or not with the Phillies. So all they could do was make sure that draft picks that all the draft picks they had that weren't currently shirtless and beer bonging while the local mayor's daughter looked on hungrily. They had to make sure all those draft picks that weren't doing that were actually signed. And Madsen was one of them. And they got him with a sweet six-figure offer that, again, this was not customary for them to be generous when signing their draft picks. So
yeah, no, that's cool. I like thinking about Pat Burrell as the anti Ted Bundy, where like Ted Bundy went to college campuses for his last, like he did most of his last like horrible, horrible killings in college campuses, and famously like, killed like four women in one night. And it's just like a horrible, horrible thing. And Pat Burrell just probably showed up at FSU and was like, hey, I'd like to bed four women in one night. And everyone cheered super loudly and he was able to do it.
I'm basically a professional athlete now, so however much success I'd have as a college athlete, let's multiply that by whatever the correct ratio is. Yeah, Pat Burrell on a one-man, I'm assuming, one-man road trip from Florida to California with professional baseball playing on the horizon. Could he have been more fertile at that point?
Honestly, that's potent right there. It's like, don't mess with it.
Well, with the short season Batavia Mug Dogs in 1999, Ryan Madsen was part of a team that won three of its first 14 games, then found its groove and won 33 of its last 49 games.
Oh, that's fun.
Madsen and Burrell were both named Minor League Pitcher and Player of the Week, respectively, in mid-May 2000. Goose Gregson, the Phillies' roving minor league pitching instructor at the time,
roving
was, yeah,
he just went to the man who
appears in my head as having a very long white beard and riding trains from town to town in which there are Phillies affiliates. Yes, Goose Gregson.
he just kind of makes his way around.
He was coaching pitchers. His philosophy, he was trying to focus on getting pitchers to go longer into games. Nobody wanted quality starts of five innings anymore. Gregson wanted every minor league pitcher to want to be the one shaking hands with the catcher after the last out is made, according to the Wilkes-Barre Citizen's Voice in July 2000. Madsen and fellow prospect Brett Myers, who newspapers correctly referred to as the next Curt Schilling, were holding down the South Atlantic League affiliate of the Phillies, doing just that. By September, the Piedmont Boll Weevils, the team they were on, were the winningest, loosest, funnest young team in the league. Fans who doubted the Phillies had a real future were told to check out what was going on in Piedmont, where a slew of guys we've still never heard of were tearing the cover off the ball. But that wasn't the best team he'd been on.
Go check out Piedmont. The classic call.
At the time, or maybe a little later, Ryan Madsen was asked if that Piedmont Bullweevils team was the best he'd ever been on, and he told a reporter the best team he'd ever been on was when he was the team he played on as a 7 and 8 year old, the team that won 53 games straight. They then lost the first game of like the next season, and he said he cried and was just utterly inconsolable.
Oh boy. Actually, one of my most prominent Ryan Madsen memories, which is weird, is him blowing a save because he looked so sad. And I remember my mother-in-law saying, I just feel so bad for him. She was so, so sad for him. And I was like, well, he's a professional baseball player. He'll be fine. She was like, what must his mother be thinking? I was like, I don't care. And on it, as an adult, I have a bit more sympathy for where she was coming from on that.
And honestly, you don't have to. He's a Major League Baseball player. He's also an enormous Major League Baseball player. He was on the rise, obviously, at this point. But do you remember him being so gigantic?
Yes.
He is listed as 6'7" in some cases. Today, I found mostly he's listed as 6'6", but one outlet did say they gave him an inch. I mean, people were excited about this. Van Rose of the Wilkes-Barre Times Leader wrote in March 2001, it's too early to refer to Ryan Madsen as a right-handed Randy Johnson, judging by his imposing stature and dazzling fastball, the young Phillies pitching prospect might one day fit the bill. This guy literally was like, this guy's tall, throws fast, Randy Johnson.
I will once again say, every time I hear a comp like that, I think of the time where And it was featured on The Good Fight in a little like side panel thing. Like it wasn't like main news, but it was like a fan. It wasn't a fan post. It was something. It was called something different back then. It was like I don't know. It was like a fan link or something. But I will say that Antonio Bastardo was in one of those links. Said he had flashes of Johan Santana, and Phillies fans should be pretty excited about that.
The only one I ever bring up because it's stuck in my mind is Dominic Brown and Daryl Strawberry. Those were
such a good one.
Yeah. Well, Madsen's career in big league ball would, we know now, not feature a lot of starting pitching. However, he did become one of the Phillies' best weapons out of the pen, the key pillar of their bridge to Lidge in 2008, and a high-velocity contributor in stressful late-inning appearances. He would go on to a long, illustrious career, going back to the playoffs every year from 2008 to 2011, winning the World Series with the Royals in 2015, going back to the postseason, briefly, of course, with the Nationals in 2017, and again with the Dodgers
nice
in 2018. Yeah, thanks. I slipped that in there. He's been to the postseason in over half the seasons he's played big league baseball.
That's shocking.
And that, I think, is pretty good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was surprised. Again, not because I wouldn't have expected it, but that's a hell of a statement to be able to make about your relief pitching career. But on May 14th, 2005, Trev, Ryan Madsen wasn't the solution. He was the problem.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and a performance that had one Inquirer writer invoke the image of Joe Carter, a bit dramatic for a regular season game in May, but okay, go for the gusto when you can.
That's weird because he wasn't even like, of all the things Ryan Madsen was, when he was bad, he was hittable. That was his problem. Mm-hmm. He wasn't wild. Like,
it was a very lazy comp.
That's
I felt like
somebody was just extraordinarily lazy. That sucks.
Somebody was just reaching. Yeah. Madsen was given a 4-2 lead to protect as the promising young setup man in the Phillies' bullpen and surrendered so furiously and so immediately that he wound up earning a number of runs in this one appearance that equaled the amount he'd given up across 13 appearances thus far in 2005. His ERA would jump over 3 points from 3.18 to 6.23.
Wow.
And this is an inning in which Aaron Harang, the pitcher, was leading off.
Oh, no.
Now, Harang led off. He gracefully grounded out to shortstop to start the inning with an out. Great. Not retiring the pitcher is a typical, it's a pretty solid pillar of any dirty inning. I feel like that's a recurring theme in a lot of these.
But Harang didn't want this to be a dirty inning. He wanted to get home.
I'm here for you, Ryan, Aaron Harang said as he jogged lazily to first base. So, you know, Madsen being able to do that, retire the pitcher, while simultaneously not letting the leadoff batter on, you know, looked like things were on track. But no Reds hitters in this inning saw more than three pitches. They were getting their results pretty immediately. So he wasn't throwing anything that was fooling anyone.
Yeah, because that, I mean, like, that, and that's it. Like, okay, lay down your Joe Carter stuff, fine, whatever. But, like, he and Mitch Williams could not be more different pitchers. Like, when Madsen, right. Madsen just, like, it seemed like every time he was bad, it would just be 32, or, like, not 32. It would be, like, 92-mile-an-hour fastballs that no one was biting on. And that's right. It. And it's like, all right, yeah. Well, today's not going to be a good one.
His command was becoming an issue on this day, completely contradict your point. He hit Ryan Friel with a pitch after Harang was out, and Friel waited maybe two pitches before snagging second base. Felipe Lopez singled without leaving the infield, and somehow Friel made it to third base with no outs being recorded. Joe Randa slapped a grounder to left field, and the dirty inning was on as Friel came in to score.
So do we have an out at this point?
Yeah, Aaron Harang.
Because you said no outs, so I got confused. I'm sorry.
Did I? Oh, my bad. Oh, no, he made it to third base with no outs being recorded on that play. Oh, it was more a commentary of a ground ball that didn't leave the infield, but the runner was safe at first, and the other runner was safe at safe at third. So it was a one-run game now to any worried Phillies fans. That's basically like you've already lost because the Reds were far from done.
I mean, honestly, like, I will come out and say it. Whenever it's a one-run game and, like, I'm worried about the game in any way, I feel as if I have already lost.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, 100%.
Well, Madsen was missing with location all night long, especially on a particular pitch to Ken Griffey Jr. with an 0-2 count. Giving the veteran slugger an up-and-away heater that you or I or maybe even our moms would have been able to at least dink back to the pitcher.
Honestly, in our case, if I could dink a ball back to the pitcher, if, like, for even for like an honest to God, like, that just dribbled to the mound and he almost didn't get me out because it wasn't hit hard enough, I would be so proud of myself.
Oh, yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, it was a pitch so hittable that might have been able to happen, but he was actually pitching to one of the best, you know, hitters
of all time.
In the history of baseball.
Yeah, not great,
and
not
so
smart.
So if we would have been able to dink it back to the pitcher, Griffey was able to pound it into the suburbs, which he did. After the Madsen explained, you do that with Griffey, as though we hadn't all been watching, and he'll hit it far. And he certainly did. With four runs in, their lead a thing of the past, and the offense knowing it already had a tall order in front of them in the bottom of the inning, the Phillies realized that, oh yeah, there were still two outs to record. Adam Dunn wasn't going to give one to them. He crushed the third pitch he saw all over the fence to go back with Griffey and give the Reds a 7-4 lead. At this point, Madsen gets pulled from the game.
Oh,
finally. Finally, at this point it was more like, how many runs can he give up before one of these other relievers is ready? And finally, Jeff Geary was ready and the bleeding stopped. They bring in Jeff Geary from the pen to clean up this mess. Madsen had allowed a double to Austin Kearns right before he left, and with that runner on second base, he wasn't on second base for long, as four pitches later, D'Angelo Jimenez hit the next double and pushed Kearns across the plate. Geary would have to rely on the Reds' 8- and 9-hole hitters to get the final two outs, wow. And LaRue and Harang graciously accepted. The truth is, nobody's ERA looks great after this one. Randy Wolfs was still at 5.14. Geary was looking at 5.87. Garbage man Terry Adams, who appeared in the last 16 games of his big league career with the Phillies in 2005. He did something to wind up with an ERA close to 12 at the end of this game.
Oh, no.
So,
well, no wonder they called him the garbage man.
Oh, I mean, you know, I'm calling him the garbage man. I don't know if
others
people
probably
of the 2005, you know, also matched me on that. But, you know, Trev, there was booing at this game. There was screaming.
Was there?
Somebody yelled, "This is a disgrace!" during the game, which is actually a pretty tame heckle.
That's a good heckle.
For a Philadelphia ballpark. Obviously, there were Eagles chants, as there always are. Trev, when three or more Philly sports fans gather, Eagles chants just sort of happen, right?
I feel like a gathering of Philly sports fans is called an Eagles.
Yeah, right. Okay, so that's
fair. I actually, when I guessed it at the Street Fight radio show in Philadelphia the, I don't know, probably about a month ago now. And when I did, I led an Eagles chant, in a way that I have never actually done in real life before. Like, I don't think I've ever led an Eagles chant. But like when I was in like a room full of Philadelphians and I was able to, it like just the mood struck me and I immediately was like, I need to.
That's great. And like, you just, you get that first letter out and it's the only one you say by yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a good feeling.
Yeah. Well, one of the hosts, if anyone listens to Street Fight, which you should, it's a great show. But one of the hosts, Brett, he asked me after, he's like, what's that chant again? And I told him, he was like, I'm an Eagles fan now. That's great. He's like, no questions.
The spelling
asked
of the word Eagles. That's terrific.
We stole it from the Jets.
Well, Geary came back the next inning and tried to out-dirty the inning that had preceded him. A pair of one-out doubles followed by a two-out sequence of walk-single made a bad day worse for the Phillies' pitching staff, guaranteeing that a miracle comeback was not in the cards. The inning ended as Madsen's had begun, with Aaron Harang batting. He made an out on both occasions, and the Phillies lost 12-4.
Wow.
It was nothing you wouldn't expect from a last place team like the Phillies were, but hopes had been high for some reason. Bobby Abreu was in one of the best runs of his career, homering in six of the team's last seven games. A few of the pieces were there. It wasn't wacky to think of the Phillies as a low seed playoff team, but it was mid-May, and you know, they were blowing games in this fashion, so people's confidence was shaky, even though, you know, they had just won their last game 12-2. It was just, I remember being at a game early in one of these seasons. I think it was one of the ones part of the run of success, started in 2007. But I remember someone shouting during a game that they were losing in April or May, remember this in October. Like, people were saying, like, these are the games we lose now. They're going to come back to bite us in the ass. And I think there was a lot of that was a prevailing sentiment at the time when the Phillies were fielding these 2005 and 2000, like other early to mid 2000 teams that actually were better than we probably remember, but really like blew it.
Yeah,
they did. They blew it. They either blew it early or they blew it late. But somewhere along the line, dumb losses like this really cost them. Losses that were almost wins. So I get the frustration.
I like that the remember this is basically like there was just a series of Phillies fans who had become who had become like Shakespearean protagonists at the end of a tragedy, like remember
addressing the crowd, yeah, or addressing the camera as the crowd's behind him, yeah. Well, we all know what happened. Madsen would eventually become a member of the Reds during his career. Aaron Harang would eventually become a member of the Phillies, and in general, everyone would just sort of be sad for a while, which they certainly were after this game. 12-4, losing to the 2005 Reds. Not the best day for the Phillies, but certainly one that qualifies as
a dirty inning.
Yeah, did you think we were going to go back and forth on the words there?
No, it's, I actually thought we were just going to say it together.
Oh, okay. I blew that. All right, so let's so something one, you would certainly two, call a
dirty
inning. Yeah,
that was pretty good. Okay. I liked
that. Three, two, yeah, that's the closest we're going to get. So, thanks again, folks, for listening to your favorite Trash Phillies podcast about how bad and dumb the team has been throughout its history. We enjoy doing it, telling you a new story every week from the lost chapters.
Believe it or not, despite calling it trash all the time, we have a great time.
I also said every week. This is actually a bi-weekly podcast.
When we are not on a hiatus.
Yeah, every other week, you can tune in to the Good Fight podcast family, where you can also receive the podcast Hittin' Season with John Stolness. You can get Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher that deal with more contemporary Phillies issues.
But why would you want that? We're supposed to plug these, right?
Liz and I are also chronicling the 10-year anniversary of the 2009 Phillies team, so that's been a lot of fun. And over on the Patreon, you get plenty of extra content from John. He likes to do This Week in Phillies History. Sometimes he'll do series previews. You get a lot of his radio appearances over there. Liz and I are reviewing terrible baseball movies every month. This month we're doing a movie called Benched, starring John C. McGinley and Garrett Hedlund, who are both actors I love. So I'm curious to see how bad this movie is. And Trev and I, of course, do bonus content related to our latest Dirty Inning. So we've actually got one coming up related to last month's Dirty Inning, because, again, we were on hiatus. And we'll
because
be
we
doing...
Were in a fight.
Yeah, because we were in a fight because a large bird landed on the wire that we use to communicate with each
other. Justin blamed me and I blamed the bird.
You can't blame a large bird for all of your life's problems.
It was a bird.
I don't want to open this whole can of worms all over again. So, folks, thanks so much for listening to The Dirty Inning. We'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you next time.